CliffCentral.com.
Let's get to Kojo, because I haven't spoken to him in ages, and it's always good to have him on the show. So Kojo's got a new book out, and we remember him from his days as an editor of many of the magazines that we love. And Kojo Bafoye is with us now this morning to talk about his new book, which is called Listen to Your Footsteps. But first, let's catch up with you. How are you, Kojo? How are things going?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Good, man. You know, the first thing anyone asks anybody these days is, have you had COVID?
No, fortunately, I have not.
Oh, thank God. All right. Then we don't have to talk about that.
And I'm really trying to keep it that way.
Thank God.
But I've been living a lockdown for about 5 years. So, I mean, hopefully that helps.
Yeah. Listen, for people who are introverted or people who are slightly misanthropic, this has been a great time. So what have you been doing during your lockdown? You've been writing books. Tell us about what you've been up to.
My life, especially that first like 6 months, my routine and my life didn't really change. I mean, I work from home. Mm-hmm. It's getting the kids to school in the morning. During lockdown, it was getting them set up in front of whatever device it was that they were using to study. And then, yeah, just kind of looking for work, doing work when it came in, freelancing. And then, yeah, writing the book. But, I mean, like my routine literally is still the same.
Well, that sounds very, to you, like no gear change at all. Very, very easy. This has been a very pleasant experience. So we were talking just a little while ago about like all the changes that have happened in everyone else's lives. And we were just joking because there are all these people who Photoshop themselves on social media all the time. Gilly and Sia were saying that there are suddenly male makeup products. Now, I know you're not in the magazine business anymore, but do you think that's a growing thing? I mean, this used to be your wheelhouse of kind of maintaining an eye, keeping an eye on trends, watching what was going on with with men, with kind of what men are interested in, grooming, dating, all that kind of thing. Is this something that's at all picked up in South Africa, or are we just on a tangent?
I don't know. Like I've seen makeup products, and the first time I actually went to a launch. Mm-hmm. It must be like 2014. I went to a launch and they had makeup products for men. I'm neither here nor there about it. Like, I personally don't think I need makeup. And, you know, if somebody else wants to wear makeup, I'll believe for them. But, you know, these things kind of come and go.
Yeah.
And I don't think things like this are not necessarily the things that are going to become mainstream. And the debate and the conversation around them usually just kind of belies whatever other prejudices or whatever other perspectives that we may have. I think there are more important things in the world to worry about. I mean, I saw yesterday this whole conversation about, I think, Richie Nisi in a skirt. Mm. And pictures of him in a skirt, and now it's discussions around masculinity and what it means. Right. And it's just like, well, actually, you know, I've got bigger fish. You know, I've got bigger things to worry about than who's deciding what they're comfortable with.
Well, I mean,
preach.
There is something to it. South Africans, we have probably some very odd ideas of what masculinity is, considering the kind of state that our society's in, and also the way that we have an outrageous level of abuse in society. That's no doubt due to the fact that men are not living up to any kind of standard. And if we have standards, they're probably the wrong ones. But it is interesting that we live in a country, too, where people, if someone wears something, like you talk about Richie Mnisi wearing a skirt, or if someone puts on makeup and they're a guy, then that gets looked at askance. In other countries, that might not be such a big deal.
Yeah, because, I mean, there's so much, in reality, there's kind of so much that we're dealing with. Mm. And I agree, like you're saying, this idea of masculinity. And there's a clinical psychologist I talked to some years back, and he kind of shaped a lot of my thinking. And he talked about masculinities as a plural. Mm. And he talked about, you know, to a certain extent, it's performative.
Right.
In terms of like we manifest like different femininities or masculinities. And the problem is that everything, all of that is tied to kind of like a particular role, a particular thing that I'm supposed to be doing. And as our society has shifted, kind of we haven't shifted with that thinking. You know, so as a man, if I'm not bringing home the bacon, you know, if I'm not bringing home the bacon, then I'm less than.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we have like hectic unemployment. Mm. Even just the employment landscape like totally changed from, let's say, pre-94 till today. It's this whole thing of that I am very much a, you know, focus on what I can control,
right,
and kind of live my own life to the best of my ability. And if the way somebody else is living their life is not destructive and doesn't impede on my life, you know, like, good for them. Like,
well,
and that's kind of been my approach. So because of that, I don't really.
You don't get wrapped
up. I don't really engage with a lot. With a lot of this stuff because I've been in the media. I watch it and I watch the conversations. But yeah,
you can observe rather than having to get involved. So listen, this brings us to your book, and I'm really interested. I'm sure Gilly and CR are too. First of all, what made you decide to write a book? And it's obviously this is drawing on your own experiences. So it's semi-autobiographical. I mean, it's a bunch of essays where you are basically speaking as a son, a father, a husband, a brother, and someone who's committed to kind of sorting themselves out in the world.
Yeah.
Which is, I suppose, all of those are things that many of us go through and that many of us would like to put down in writing. It's a therapeutic exercise, first of all. It's cathartic. But what was the main motivation for actually getting it done? Because all of us have a book in our heads. Very few of us actually end up writing them down.
So, look, my first book, I started it in 2012 when I was actually still a Destiny man.
Right.
And it was around fatherhood. So it was after my son was born, I started kind of scribbling stuff and reflecting on that journey. I never got around to finishing it just because of time. I mean, I was in the magazine, I was busy, I was doing, you know, kind of running around doing a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
I did believe that I had a book in me, and I write every day. I mean, I continue to write every day because that's my work.
Right.
So about a year and a half ago, I actually just started writing, you know, putting these thoughts down as little essays, little reflections, because I also journal every morning. So the first thing I do in the morning is I do morning pages. So I journal for like 3 pages before I do anything else. And I started kind of building a little collection of these, you know, some long, some short, these essays and these reflections. And reached out to Pat McMillan, who I had a relationship with and I'd been kind of conversating with him before to go.
But didn't you have, because you've published 2 books of poetry before this as well. So it's not as if you're new to the idea of publishing.
Yeah, but that feels weird because, I mean, like, I self-published. My father paid for the printing of the books. I put the things together. It didn't feel like real publishing.
Okay.
Like, I had a strange form of imposter syndrome when it came to actually being an author. You know, friends would say, you've published your own books. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, like my father said, why don't you publish a book of poetry? And I'm like, I don't have money. He says, well, I'll pay for the printing. So like, okay, cool. Then I'll put a book together. Like, you know, I know enough people. I know photographers. A friend of mine took a picture of the cover. I compiled the poems, edited them, went to a publisher and said, hey, listen, I've got this book. How much? And they told me, and I gave them the book and the cover, and then they gave me 500 copies later.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it counts. I mean, these days, self-publishing is
actually... And you have a great relationship with your dad. I mean, let's count our blessings, you know.
Absolutely.
Now, yeah, my father was my main and only parent from... Yeah. When I was, what, 14 months?
Your mom,
and he believed in you, which is great.
Your mom died when you were very young, and you talk about that in the book. You talk about being raised only by your dad and kind of how you formed your identity around that. Now, it's a different story to most people who, you know, there's so many people in South Africa raised by single moms. I think that alone is an interesting take on things, which we haven't heard more than we certainly haven't heard as much as we have from single moms or from kids who've been raised by single moms. So it would be interesting to compare the experiences. And then also living as an immigrant, because You are of German and Ghanaian extraction. You lived in Lesotho for a long time. You're South African now. And all of that must have been an interesting way to shape the character that you are, because there's no doubt that you've really made an impact in the media world. You've been one of those people whose name is well known, and you're one of those people who's produced some great stuff. And I'm just interested in where you think the major influences in your life might have come from.
As a starting point, my father. And so some of these things, I mean, the interesting thing is, if for example, I'd stayed in Lesotho, I do wonder whether I'd have been able to, or I'd have written this book this way. Because moving to South Africa and the challenges and the journey of this country has forced me to really look at certain things. When I was growing up in Lesotho, I was my father's son. My father was well known in the society. It was a small, it's obviously a smaller kind of society and smaller city than Johannesburg. And I was my father's son, and I was, my younger brother and sister's older brother. Or I was the guy who went to that school who was interested in these things, or that, or went to these parties, or hung out with that group of people. And it's in coming to South Africa where, all of a sudden, I'm having conversations around, just because I have a particular complexion, hair texture, doesn't mean that I have to be colored. And what that means for identity.
This is such a prickly subject, but I love getting into it, because what certain people regard as their colored identity, especially here in South Africa, is so different to what other people think of when they think of their colored identity. I mean, in America they say mixed race. They would never use the word colored because it's actually a slur. You've got people who have a white parent and a black parent. You have people who have two colored parents. You have people who have a mixture of those different things. And they all see each other in different ways. And they see themselves in different ways. And there isn't really a straightforward colored identity, is there, Kojo?
I think there is. And I say that because within a South African context, I view colored as let's call it an ethnic group, in the same way that you'd have Zulu, Xhosa, Sotho, etc. Mm-hmm. The challenge becomes when you come from outside. So within a South African context, there is an ethnic group that is colored. That's kind of my view, and it took me a while to kind of get to that point to make sense of it. Outside of South Africa and the U.S., the reason why colored is considered a slur is historical, and you have to look at it contextual. You went from colored, Negro, et cetera, et cetera. And mm-hmm. there's that journey and there's that very specific context. So you have people like me, for example, who, let's say I'm biracial. Depending on where you are in the world, I'm biracial, I'm mixed race.
Yeah.
And from a, let's call it an ethnicity or a heritage perspective, like I'm operating with Ghanaian and German. That's kind of my heritage. And that influences, you talk about influences, that also influences kind of my version of culture, how I view the world, my ritual, etc. The problem, the challenge becomes, and the challenge I had when I came to South Africa, is that that's tied to race as opposed to
culture,
as opposed to heritage or culture, right? And in South Africa, I found that even with say black, there was no understanding of nuance, because you can be black, but black people are so nuanced within this country. Whereas with whites, the nuance was there. And I found that especially working in the media, right?
So that's a fascinating thing to reflect on, because, South Africa apparently has the second largest or the largest German population outside of Germany in the Southern Hemisphere. They've also, we've kind of got stereotypical ideas of what Germans are, and some of them are funny and some of them are really quite insulting. But it's interesting, this idea of, of culture versus race, because South Africans haven't really grappled with that properly.
We're
still. Do you agree, Gilly? I mean, we're still dealing with race.
I can tell you that from a, you know, you talk about nuance. It's interesting. Like I used to think you were right, that there was no understanding of nuance in black culture. But in my experience of performing for audiences all over this country, I learned very, very quickly the hard way that there was no one seeing the nuance in my, I'm seen as a white woman. Even when I talk about being Jewish, that is now something, a foreign thing that I've now introduced. And there's no, there's very, very few audiences that I perform for where they go, oh, I understand that is another thing or an additional thing or a nuanced part of the thing. For the most part, I think we lack an understanding of nuance in one another's races and cultures.
And I think also the openness to recognize that we each have different experiences.
Yeah.
And therefore, there's no experience that's more valid than the next.
Yeah.
And for us to find our way through this is to open ourselves up more to that. I mean, I really believe one of the biggest causes of ills in this world overall it is a lack of empathy. And I do write about it in the book. Like I try to teach, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how you go about doing that, but it's essentially, you know, empathy for me means kind of recognizing the similarities, while recognizing the differences, but also just understanding that the next person is, you know, is going through their experience, and taking the time to really, well, try and understand what that experience is. And even where you don't understand, just recognizing that, like I said, as long as it's not destructive, as long as it doesn't impact on society in a particular way, like I'm happy to let them go through that. But it's this element of understanding and taking the time to try and understand.
Well, again, we have limited resources in that respect. You can't take time to understand everybody. Otherwise, you're going to be so busy doing that all day, you're going to get nothing else done. And we were talking about earlier how, you know, it's impossible these days. Someone gave me a useful definition a while ago, which I quite like. Empathy is putting yourself in someone else's shoes, which is difficult for all of us to do because we don't know what path they've walked, right? So empathy is a much harder, much more difficult mountain to climb if you truly wish to be empathetic. I almost prefer the definition for compassion, where even though you don't necessarily understand someone's life and you haven't been there every step of the way with them, you can still make an effort to take them seriously and to appreciate their experience and to sympathize in some way with what difficulties they've been through. And I think compassion and empathy are quite different things. Someone explained that to me once, and I'm not even sure if I've explained it properly enough here. But
Gareth, it's interesting. Like, I think we talk about words like compassion and empathy where we live in a society where, you know, you're a person who deals with the public, but if you're dealing one-on-one with people, which is what we're doing most of the time, we don't even get to compassion and empathy because most of us can't even listen. That thing is so critical. Like, it's such a critical step before anything else happens. You know, oh, somebody is telling me about their experience, let me listen and not have a knee-jerk, you know, opposite reaction to whatever's coming at me. And for me, that's changed so many things because I know myself how that compassion and the empathy has only come after I've shut my mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point.
And I guess it's also the thing of not having to have an opinion about everything. And sometimes, like you're saying, totally. sometimes actually just kind of listening and taking it in, and it's, you know, it is what it is. Like I acknowledge you, I've heard you. I don't need to now counteract you. I don't need to have a debate with you about it. It's just like, okay, well, that's interesting. That's an interesting perspective. Thank you. I don't do it well.
Me either. It's hard for a lot of us.
But even worse are those people who they listen to you, but then they try to solve your problems for you. Like it's this patronizing idea that, oh, I know how to get out of the tussle you're in. I've got some information that, you know, you immediately assume that you know more than that person and you're going to solve their problems. That's the worst kind of.
But you know what? I've been guilty of that because I'm a person who, you know, that is my knee jerk. And I've had to teach myself not to do that. So, Kojo, you talk about like, oh, how do we teach empathy? It's like, oh, firstly, what is your intention? And it took me a long time to understand, wait, what do I want out of these interactions that I'm having? Mm. Oh, maybe I do want more information. I want to learn something. In order to listen, I'm going to have to change my thing, my knee-jerk thing, which is what you describe, of trying to give my opinion on a subject or trying to solve a problem that's in front of me, you know?
I'm just thinking, trying to navigate, like, marriage, right?
Yeah. You talk about marriage in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, being married is something where, you know, the other person is telling you something. And I'm also instinctively like a problem solver. You know, so it's like this person at work is doing this. And it's like, well, actually, what you should be doing is this. And the person just wanted you to listen. They just wanted to be able to vet. Right. Just kind of get stuff out of their head and off their chest. And there you are now jumping in and going, yeah, well, what you should do is, like, you know, to hell with them. And you must do this, and you must call your boss, and you must go to HR.
Totally.
Like, actually, I didn't want any of that. I just wanted you to listen.
You also write in the book about substance abuse, which is something I didn't know that you'd been through these tussles. Tell us a little bit about that, because that must have been difficult to write, you know, especially because most people are ashamed of these things, or they haven't yet dealt with them in a significant way, or perhaps they're worried about what people will think of them or how it could impact on their career. How did that come about?
I mean, I guess I'd shared the story before, just never at this level.
Hmm.
To a certain extent, I've built like a career of just telling the stuff that I've gone through. I did it in smaller ways, like it was an editor's note or it was a blog post or that sort of stuff. I mean, I used to do some kind of drug education, going around to schools and kind of talking about it. And it was kind of me coming to Joburg and getting a little caught up in, let's call it, the rave scene in those days. I mean, like the late 90s. But it was more around in my inadequacies my adequacies as a human being. And that, you know, before I even moved to Joburg and had, you know, issues with certain substances, I had problems with alcohol. Growing up in a small town where literally that's what you do.
Yeah.
You drink. That's the first thing that you do. On a Saturday, you have your first drink around lunchtime. And, you know, you're just popping a can of this. And then by the time it gets darker, you're drinking, you know, other things. So it was a journey. And fortunately for me, it was primarily within a year. And I had people around me that kind of opened me up or at least gave me options and exposed me to the options. And part of that journey of getting off it was starting to do that work on myself, like, and starting to understand myself and understand my triggers and that sort of stuff. And it's been long enough that I don't know if in South Africa we have a statute of limitations. I mean, we watch so many American movies, we understand.
Yeah.
We understand their laws better than ours.
Right.
But I figured, you know, like 20 years.
Yeah,
20 years is a good. It's a good enough period to leave between it. Nobody official will come chasing after me.
No, that's expired. You don't have to worry. I'm also I think people's attitudes to drugs have changed so much. You said something really interesting at the beginning of this explanation that you've just given for why you included it in the book. You said you were dealing with some stuff, and I think, you know, it refers back to that experiment they've done with the mice, where they put them in a cage, and they give the mouse on its own. They give it cocaine in the water, and it keeps coming back, and it drinks only because they're two little water things, and the one is just plain water and the other one's got cocaine, and the mouse that's on its own has to have the cocaine water, and the mouse that's got company and that has, you know, things to play on and things to do in its cage, it drinks the normal water. They never choose the cocaine water. So I think that that's a really interesting explanation of why so many people get into it, and it's not because they just didn't have anything else to do, or because they were bored, or because there was peer pressure. It's usually because there's something that they don't have, or that they're striving for, or that they feel left out of. There's some issue that's holding them back. And the drugs kind of help them to assuage any kind of feelings of insecurity. And that's where it starts, certainly.
I mean, absolutely. I think that's where it starts. I mean, everybody goes to it, but different people get to it in different ways. I mean, mine was literally just a Saturday afternoon. I'd been drinking and had a joint, and I was having a disagreement with a young lady whose opinion mattered. And I wasn't getting high. And I was with a friend of mine, and I was like, listen, like, okay, this is irritating now. I need, I need something that'll just, help me forget about all this stuff and, numb me a little bit, and then we can go partying after this.
Right.
And he gave me a white pill and said, they gave me half of it and said, chew on it.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, it tastes like crap, but I'll do that. And then, two, 3 hours later, I'm looking at the lights and going, oh my God, look at those lights. and that's kind of, and then it became kind of like part of my, it became part of my lifestyle. I mean, I used to park outside. I stayed with my aunt / my mom in Craig Hall. So I used to drive past Hyde Park, and in those days Hyde Park had these purple lights on top. Some of us are old enough to remember, but these, like, Hyde Park was purple after midnight. And I'd actually park on the side of the road after having had a couple of ecstasy pills and maybe a couple of lines of cocaine, and I'd park on the side of the road at 4 o'clock in the morning and just gaze at Hyde Park.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, Kojo, you think that's bad? You're talking about the early rave scene in Joburg. You know, I developed a strong affinity for bomber jackets. It was also a lifestyle.
Well, so my bomber jacket, but I had no problem with bomber jackets, because my bomber jacket was actually probably a decade earlier.
Yeah.
I was in Germany and I had a Public Enemy bomber jacket.
Ooh. Wow.
And that was like my pride and joy.
Yeah,
and
you win.
No wonder you got into the rave scene. You had to wear that thing somewhere.
Yeah. No, you win.
It's not your fault.
Well, the book is it's out now. It is available. You can get it online, right? So that's the best place to buy it. And it's called Listen to Your Footsteps by Kojo Bafoye. There's the cover. That's a good picture of you. Who took that?
Victor Dlamini.
Very nice.
Good friend of mine, and he takes amazing pictures.
All right, so Listen to Your Footsteps is the book, and Kojo is doing what he does so well. He's also been on Kaya FM, for those people who don't know, Black Magazine, Destiny Man, Afropolitan, so many things to talk about, and we've always got time to talk to you. Thanks, Kojo. Nice to see you, man.
Thanks, you guys.
Congrats on the book.
Yeah, congrats on the book. Very good. Cheers, Kojo. There he is. CliffCentral.com.